Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Bennington, Vermont. This talk, delivered on Sunday, March 8, 2026, is by the Reverend Barbara Threet on the topic of Unitarians in Transylvania.
There are around 130 Unitarian churches in the part of Central Romania that's historically called Transylvania, over 40 Unitarian congregations in northern India, and about two dozen Universalist congregations in the Philippines. They became Unitarian Universalists in the 1980s. There are about 150 Unitarian congregations in Great Britain. Many of them are sort of half a dozen people, whether they constitute a congregation or not, you could argue, but they're there. And there are half a dozen Unitarian Christian congregations in Indonesia. There are some in Australia and New Zealand. They're scattered around. There are several in Europe, although they're mostly expat UUs from the States. Our Unitarian Universalist Association serves only the United States at this point, but we have connections with all these congregations beyond our borders through our Office of Global Connection and Emerging Communities. Many of these congregations in Romania, India, and the Philippines have partnered with American Unitarian Universalist congregations. The Melrose UU congregation, where I served for 9 years before retiring, was partnered with a congregation. Those of you who are new should know that I retired from ministry 10 years ago. I now serve two churches part-time. Last year, I served three part-time. I don't know what retirement is. I visited Romania several times. So this morning, I'm actually going to tell you a bit about how Unitarianism came to exist in Transylvania and what it looks like now. The first thing to know is that Unitarianism existed in Romania long before it was ever here in the U.S. In fact, it existed long before there was a United States, before there were any Europeans on this continent at all. Unitarian ideas appeared in Western Europe in the early 1500s, when many new religions formed, usually based on either objections to the practice of the Catholic Church or as a result of careful Bible study and coming to conclusions that were different than Catholic theology. Some of the ones that differed on theology were the early Unitarians. They believed that there's only one God, and while Jesus is a respected teacher and worthy of adoration and following and all those things, they believed that he wasn't God, according to the Bible. They opposed the doctrine of the Trinity. They were called anti-Trinitarians and eventually Unitarians, one God. By the mid-1500s, their theology had taken root in a part of the world that has been called Transylvania for over 1,000 years, long before there was anything about Bram Stoker. Transylvania simply means beyond the forest, and it's an area of roughly 40,000 square miles, about the size of Kentucky, in quite the middle of what's now Romania, encircled by the Carpathian Mountains. So how did Unitarians wind up there? Well, I'll tell you some of the story. It starts in Eastern Hungary in 1539, when its King John married Isabella, the daughter of the King of Poland. Hungary was part of the great Habsburg Empire, and it was quite large. It included much of what's now Romania. One of the king's good friends was the very powerful Sultan Suleiman of the Ottoman Empire, often called Suleiman the Great. And while they really were friends, Suleiman also supported John's reign in order to keep Hungary as kind of a buffer between the Ottoman Empire and Western Europe. And then King John died shortly after the birth of he and Queen Isabella's only child, John Sigismund. The Sultan feared that the ruler of Western Hungary would try to move into Eastern Hungary, thus removing that buffer that he wanted. It's unclear whether Suleiman offered or whether Isabella requested, but Suleiman, a Muslim, became the guardian of Isabella and her son. There is no evidence of a romance between them, but their correspondence indicates a deep and mutual respect, and it does still exist. There's a painting of Isabella holding her son as she talks directly to the Sultan, which would have been highly unusual for a woman in that time, but it's determined that it's probably really happened. Suleiman and Isabella were concerned that if she stayed in central Hungary, there would be efforts to kill her and her son so that that property could go with the ruler on the other part of Hungary. So Suleiman declared that Isabel was to move in the far, far eastern part of Hungary, known as Transylvania, and rule on John Sigismund's behalf until he reached adulthood. Queen Isabella ruled well, with the strong support of Sultan Suleiman. He arranged for local taxes to go to her rather than to the Ottomans. He provided safe transport for Isabella and her son to visit Constantinople several times, gave money to her household, and helped her to hold European forces at bay for many years. In 1559, Isabella died, and her son John Sigismund, who was barely out of his teens, became king, with Suleiman's strong support. Thanks to the preaching of his court priest, Ferenc David, King John Sigismund had come to believe that there was only one God, not a Trinity. Jesus was a great teacher and worthy of study and respect, but only God was God. Transylvania had become a hotbed of religious diversity. It was so far east that the Inquisition simply wasn't very powerful there. Calvinists and Lutherans had settled, and anti-Trinitarians had come from Poland and Italy. There were struggles as to which religion was acceptable and which was heretical. And finally, in 1568, King John Sigismund issued what's called the Edict of Torda. Torda is a city in what's now Romania. It was the first law anywhere to specifically sanction what became the Unitarian faith. It proclaimed that Calvinist, Catholic, Lutheran, Orthodox, and Unitarian religions were all state-sanctioned. All were to be tolerated. Further, it said that each person could choose which religion to follow. It read in part, "Our Royal Majesty, as he has decided that every orator shall preach the gospel as his own personal conception, at any place if the community is willing to accept him, or if it is not, then no one shall force him, just because their soul is not satisfied with him. But a community can keep any preacher whose teachings are delightful. And no one may hurt a preacher. No one may be blamed because of their religion. No one is allowed to threaten others with prison or divest anyone of their office because of their profession of faith, because all faith is God's gift born from hearing, and this hearing is conceived by the word of God." Subsequent history is less inspiring. King John Sigismund died in 1578, and the next king tried to bring back Catholicism, although other religions didn't disappear. But in 1572, the Unitarians agreed to stop any further religious innovation. They would freeze where they were. Over the centuries, toleration for Unitarians and other faiths has waxed and waned. At its peak, there were over 600 Unitarian congregations in Transylvania. Now there are around 130. They are mostly quite small and much more Christian than most of our American Unitarian Universalist churches, partly due to that agreement not to do any further innovation, and partly due to centuries of isolation from other Unitarians, but mostly because of severe repression of all religions in that part of the world, including but not limited to Unitarians. The area known as Transylvania has been part of many different alliances or countries over the past 1,000 years, and in 1920, Transylvania was taken from Hungary and given to Romania in the Treaty of Trianon, which is a whole different thing. Many Transylvanians still are resentful about that and identify more as Hungarians than as Romanians. From the mid-1940s until 1989, Romania was occupied or controlled by the USSR, and religion was strongly repressed. When Ceausescu came to power in 1965, he became convinced that Romania would become a major industrial power, built masses of factories to prepare for that. If only everyone would leave their little towns and move into cities, adopt the city lifestyle and work in his factories. Religious gatherings were outlawed and entire towns were bulldozed in an attempt to eradicate religion and the rural way of life. Romania became quite isolated, regarded as a backwater country and largely ignored. And then in 1989, about the time Ceausescu fell, the then president of our Unitarian Universalist Association, Reverend Bill Schultz, learned of the destruction of many small Unitarian villages in Transylvania. And he encouraged UU congregations to form partnerships with those congregations. Probably the best way to explain the current Unitarian Church to you is to describe my first visit there in the summer of 2008. I became the minister in Melrose in 2007, and I was elated when they asked me to visit our partner church. And so I went for the first of many trips to Romania. After spending a few days in Budapest, I took a train into Romania. It was an experience. The train was ancient and shabby. It felt like it was barely moving. It had wooden seats and no AC. The scenery across Hungary was pretty, with fields of sunflowers and other crops, but it also was increasingly poor. After crossing the Romanian border, several hours in, I saw mile after mile of massive, massive and abandoned factories, rusted train tracks with abandoned cars, lots of scraggly trees and weeds and decay. It was depressing, even ugly. And I began to wonder what I had stumbled into and whether it was even a safe place to be. It looked like bombs. It was just awful. But then I began to see green fields with long, narrow ribbons of crops stretching up gentle slopes and people working them by hand, hand plows, scythes. Then I noticed a few houses and eventually small towns, often painted in very, very bright colors, green with shockingly purple trim, screaming orange houses, gaudy fences of varied colors. It looked like a coloring book gone mad. There were mostly dirt roads, high wooden fences around every single house, homestead. Every house had a garden. Many had flower beds, but there wasn't a sign of a lawn. There was always a dog wandering loose in the yard. And old sheds, a horse cart, a doghouse, a wheelbarrow in that dirt yard. Each house I noticed had a table and a chairs over an underhang near the front doorway, and the doorway was always covered with a lace curtain. There were horse-drawn wagons on the road, a few drawn by water buffalo, but mostly horses. There were men cutting hay in the field with scythes. There were women washing clothes in round red basins in the yard. It felt like I had entered some other century. As the train neared the city, Hungarians still call it Kolozsvár, although the Romanians call it Cluj. And depending on what map you find, you might find one or two or even three names. Some of the towns also have German names. There were massive, ugly, Soviet-style concrete apartment buildings. If you've ever seen them in the country, they really are ugly, and they almost immediately look like they're falling apart. They were remnants of the Ceausescu era and before. The women, I noticed, were wearing a striking combination of dull and worn-out peasant clothes and really bright patterns and really strange colors in very odd combinations. Later, I learned that the wild colors were in part because of Ceausescu. Under his regime, everything went toward the dream of being an industrial powerhouse, and there weren't things like house paint or colorful fabric available. So when colors became available, then again, they were embraced with abandon. If you'd had years of a faded gray house, why not use hot pink or fluorescent blue or both? And once Western clothing was available, the more colorful and the more layers and the more Western looking, the better. That's changed some, but it was quite striking. And the village, Little Iklan, which is partnered with Melrose. I visited many little Unitarian villages over the years, and Iklan is typical. A few dozen houses set along a few roads, or a couple dozen houses setting along a few roads. In 2008, the main road through town was poorly paved, but paved. But the four roads which split off were all dirt, badly rutted. There were around 30 or 40 houses in town and more in the outlying areas. A small general store slash bar and a community center, which housed a primary school. I think it went to third grade. Up one of the dirt streets stood two churches, the Unitarian and the Calvinist, which sits next to the Unitarian Church on land that the Unitarians donated. A parsonage for the Unitarian minister was just up the street, And since the church lacked central heating, the main room of the parsonage was used for services during the winter and for social activities. That parsonage was unique in that the front door opened onto that one large room, and there were bedrooms and a kitchen off of it. But most houses were much simpler. The front door leads into a small kitchen with an emphasis on small, with a counter to hold the red basin, a stove, a few shelves, a half fridge, and an area for hanging coats. There'd be a larger room next to it, which held a couch that became a bed, a table and chairs for eating meals when it's cold, a wood stove of some sort, a small wardrobe, a TV, maybe a bookshelf or an easy chair. And as children arrive, other rooms are added on kind of railroad style. So you have the tiny kitchen, a living room, dining room, kitchen, every room, and then a kid's room here, and maybe a kid's room here, and maybe a kid's room there. It intrigued me that when the bedrooms were added, there usually weren't doors in them, just doorways. Every house has a very large root cellar, a very large garden, and an outhouse. Virtually all the houses in the town in 2008 had a well in their yard, and water was drawn up as needed. By the last time I visited in 2018, many of the wells were capped with cold water pipe indoors, but the water was still heated on a stove. I stayed with the family of the church's board president, none of whom spoke any English. And while I learned some over my decade of visiting, that first time that I went, all I really knew how to say, so that I was confident in it, was, "Hello, thank you, and you're welcome." Even goodbye was Visantatashara, which I couldn't remember. Fortunately, Iklan's Unitarian minister spoke English well. That's a requirement when they're in seminary, so she translated. But then she went home for the night. I was quite surprised when very early on my first morning in the village, before I was really even awake, the woman of the family quietly brought in a small red basin of hot water with a bar of soap and a towel. That was bathing. And I should say that the people and their houses and their clothes are all kept scrupulously clean. Those round red plastic basins, about so deep, are used to wash clothes, wash dishes, gather vegetables, provide bathing water, carry leftover food to the pig, truly multi-purpose. When I first visited, most people had water buffaloes or horses that pulled their carts and wagons. The last time I went in 2016, there were a few tractors, but they weren't terribly practical. You'll find out why later. Every household has chickens. Each household raises a pig every year. And the rabbits in the hutch are not pets. As for the church itself, were this a typical Transylvanian Unitarian church? It's a little bigger than some of them, but some are this big. The entryway would be right about where you're sitting. There would be an entryway all across that there. And there would be a little staircase up here leading to the bell tower, and the bell tower would be directly above you. Entering the sanctuary itself, there would be several rows of wooden box pews. You've probably seen wooden box pews in old New England churches. And they would fill from there all the way probably to about here. That's where the women sit. The pulpit would be a little bit more this way. It's usually up at least half a dozen steps that are steep and windy. And there's a rail about so high that goes around it. Along the wall, past where the minister stands, are just a few chairs. And they are for visiting dignitaries, for the husband or wife of the clergy person, and there are several women ministers, or for anybody who is coming as a government official, which apparently happens occasionally. There'd be an open space in front of the pulpit. There'd be a little table on it. Sometimes it has flowers. Sometimes it holds the communion, if it's a communion Sunday. And on the far side are probably three rows, right where the minister can keep an eye on them, and that's where the children and the teens sit. Over on this side would be just a few rows of seats for the men. And in the back there would be a chair stairway that goes up, and there's a little balcony above the men. Clearly, more women are expected to attend church than the men. I don't know why. there would be a hymnal in each seat, and they would have little cloth covers carefully embroidered by the women of the church. And the pews themselves are hard wood, no padding, well worn. There would be several windows high and tall on that wall, so if you look out at all you can see is the sky. There'd be an outhouse out back, but no mowed lawn. In the summer, the grass would be cut with a scythe and given to the minister to use for their animals. The churches have steep roofs to shed the snow, and they're made of a sort of kind of adobe plaster stuff over wood, and they're all painted white. The floors are bare wood. Only a few wealthy city churches have carpets. A few of those wealthy city churches actually allow men and women to sit together, which is pretty radical. There are no attached classrooms or offices. Classes and meetings are held in the main room of the parsonage, and each church is responsible for its own upkeep, rather like we are, but they get assistance from the bishop's office. And yes, there is a bishop. The Transylvanian Unitarian Church is much more hierarchical than American churches. Churches receive a stipend from the government, as does the bell ringer. The bell ringer is actually a highly sought after and very prestigious role to have. You sound the church bell several times during the week in addition to Sundays, and it has to be done on time. And the music in Transylvanian churches, the music. Some churches have organs up there. A few of them are used, but mostly the people sing a cappella. And the songs, I regret to say, all come out as dirges, sung badly, no matter the words or the tunes. Folk music can be very lively and uplifting and beautiful. Oh, heat, old Saratat, old Saratat, old Beckett, old Beckett, old, I will not keep going. But that is what it sounds like, except it's even slower. It is dreadful. One of the first times that I was there, I was invited to go to a minister's meeting. There were tons of ministers. It was very hot. I was very tired. And I was having a terrible time staying awake. And then they began to sing those songs. I thought I would die. That song that I, sang, the words would translate as, where there is faith, there is love. Where there is love, there is peace. Where there is peace, there is blessing. And the song goes on and would end with, where there is God, everything is okay. But you would never know anything about that from the way that the song sounds. They're lovely people. They can't sing hymns. The people are deeply dedicated to being Unitarian, though. It means a lot to them. Many spoke about sneaking out at night to gather in someone's house for worship during the Ceausescu years. They told of hiding the communion silver under piles of dung in their barns, sometimes for years and years. Unitarians and other religions came under severe persecution, and their property was often confiscated. Those long ribbons of fields that I mentioned, they're because the property of citizens and churches was seized, and after long legal battles, after Ceausescu was deposed, it was returned, but only sort of. If a 10-acre plot of rich cropland was seized, 10 acres of land would be given back. But it was probably a narrow strip here, a chunk of swampland there, another strip in another place, done intentionally to make farming more difficult. And that's part of why farming with modern tools like tractors becomes so difficult, because their property is scattered all over. And some people have gradually traded or found ways to get around that, but it was a very intentional decision. The Unitarian churches in Transylvania face the same demographic dilemmas of aging congregations that we do, but for different reasons. When religions are actively persecuted, children don't grow up with any experience of organized religion. And often parents hid their religious activities from their children in case the kids inadvertently told the wrong people. The Unitarians are heavily concentrated in Transylvania, and they identify first as Transylvanians, then as Hungarians, and only last as Romanians. For many, it seems that they're more culturally Unitarian than religiously. I didn't hear a whole lot of discussion about theology. But it means a lot to them to be part, to have that Unitarian heritage. The Unitarian Church is the center of their lives in the small towns, and their worship services and their home lives are all conducted in Hungarian. That forms a strong cultural bond, certainly, but it's also a disadvantage. The children learn some Romanian in school, but they need to prove fluency in order to get into university, and few can do so. And when people are looking for jobs in the cities, if other people are speaking Romanian, they can be out of luck. The Romanian government has tried to eradicate the Hungarian language and culture. And outside of Transylvania, Hungarian is rarely seen or heard. There's a university in one of the cities that theoretically is a combination of an old Romanian and a Transylvanian college, but there's absolutely no Hungarian there. And when I tried to speak Hungarian to somebody in the office, she said, "In Romanian, we don't say that." We share a common Unitarian theology with our Transylvanian cousins and a commitment to simple worship spaces with services conducted in the vernacular, and that's a big deal. There's a similar sense of community, a lot of social interactions between members in those little villages beyond Sunday, especially since there's a significant number of townspeople who are Unitarian. But we've developed quite differently in other ways. Their children, 6th, 7th, 8th grade, still memorize an extensive catechism recited publicly at their confirmation. I had the privilege of going to a confirmation and got food poisoning, but that's another story. Clergy enter seminary at a young age, sometimes after college, but often directly from high school, and they remain as clergy for the rest of their lives. Several mentioned to me that one of the problems they had is that they hadn't had any experience of life other than being a child and then being a clergy person. And they were envious of us Americans who tend to go into ministry in middle age. Churches do provide a parsonage for the minister and his family with a garden and a woodlot and a shelter for animals. And there are about as many women ministers as men. Those churches are much more Christian. Communion is celebrated several times a year, and every service included Bible readings. I want to say a bit about Christian Unitarians, because people wonder about that even in this country. For many Christians, and the mental picture that many of us have of Christianity means that Jesus provides a path to eternal life. For Unitarian Christians, whether it's in Romania or in our own congregation, Jesus is regarded as a wise teacher whose life is inspiring, even the center of their spiritual practice. They simply don't believe that he's divine. Unitarian Christians' assessment of Jesus is probably akin to how Muslims view Muhammad. He's a person with particular role and value, but not God. Only God, or Allah, is divine, but God's teachers, Jesus and Muhammad, are worthy of reference. There's a lot less emphasis on social justice in the Transylvanian churches. LGBTQ communities and issues are still suspect in Romania. Immigration is not a big issue, and churches are not considered to be vehicles for social change. The prejudice against the people who are still called the Gypsies is strong. The Ikland Unitarian Church was one of the few with some Gypsy members, and it was clear that not everyone was happy that they were part of the congregation. What struck me most strongly, though, is how important their Unitarian identity is, and the lengths to which many of them went in order to keep that faith alive despite centuries of persecution. It is beyond my comprehension to have to creep out of my door under cover of darkness in order to gather for worship, to have to speak or even sing in whispers. I've wondered if that's why they sing so badly. I don't know. To have to agonize over whether to tell my children what I believe, because if they mention it to the wrong people, our lives could be at risk. And that was the situation. I was and still am inspired by the tenacity, the dedication, and the hospitality of the Transylvanian Unitarians. I enjoyed seeing the differences between our churches and worship and theirs. And it is fascinating to be in a village where so many people share the same religion as part of their identity. I didn't sense any exclusion toward those who weren't Unitarian. After all, they had donated the space for the Calvinist church. But there is a deep, shared Unitarian and Transylvanian history and a strong sense of being community. So there's a bit about our Unitarian cousins in a very different place and in quite a different way. I went several times and studied Hungarian and got nowhere near fluent, but enough so they could understand me in the village where they were patient, and I've forgotten most of it, but I'll try. Nagyon szépen köszönöm, hogy meghallgattál, which means many thanks for listening.